Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is May 27th, 2020, and my guest is author and physician Vivian Lee. She is president of Health Platforms at Verily Life Sciences, an Alphabet company whose mission is to apply digital solutions that enable people to enjoy healthier lives. Her book is The Long Fix, which is our topic for today. Vivian, welcome to Econ Talk.
Hey, great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Vivian, your book starts off with what I think you call and what I would call the central problem in American healthcare: doctors paid to do stuff to us rather than to take care of us. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, you know, that is really the fundamental question, I think, in healthcare right now. The fact that we are paid to do things to people means that, like in a time of crisis, instead of focusing on areas like prevention and public health, we are focused on generating fees. That means we invest our resources in things like operating rooms, imaging centers, and the like. And when we are incentivized to do that, even though most physicians, I believe, certainly in my own practice, try to do the right thing, nevertheless, the system is incentivizing us to do more to people, regardless of whether they actually improve health outcomes. When you have that as a driver in the healthcare system, the counterbalance is really now the insurance company or the payer. So the insurance company or payer says, no, we don't want you to spend that much money. We need to put in some controls. And the controls they put in are things like barriers, their denials of coverage, their prior authorization, for example. So your doctor might order an MRI and they'll say, no, you need to have fill out all this paperwork in order to get that approved. So the two behemoths of healthcare, provider systems, insurance, fighting back and forth, wasting, by the way, an enormous amount of money just in the administrative work. 8% of the healthcare dollar right now is being spent on administration alone, compared to 3% for OECD nations, other OECD nations.
And that estimate.
A lot of waste, a lot of frustration. And then when they can't resolve it, it falls down to patients in balance billing or surprise billing, which we hear a lot about in the headlines. So we have a pretty dysfunctional system that leads to over-treatment and over-diagnosis and just simply overdoing at the expense of better health.
Yeah, I think the waste you talked about, I think you said 8% for the administrative burden. One, I suspect that's an underestimate. I think that's probably a formal measure of salaries of people in the business of keeping track of stuff, as opposed to the distraction to doctors to have to always show that they've met some standard or justify a code that's in the data. To me, the biggest quote waste is the over testing, the over diagnosis, the over treatment, and as we know, a lot of that, even preventive care, especially some preventive care, I'm thinking of various scans and checks, is not even positive. It's not just that it's a waste; some of it's harmful to health.
That's exactly right. In fact, when I was writing this book, one of the really surprising statistics that I share with readers is the fact that medical mistakes are the third leading cause of death in this country. The third leading cause of death in this country. Estimates are over a couple of hundred people a year in the U.S. die from medical mistakes. That's really one of the consequences of a healthcare system that is focused so much on simply doing things to people, regardless of outcome. I know you're a card-carrying economist, so I say what I'm about to say, I say with some trepidation, but I do feel like our healthcare system is designed to fly into the headwinds of capitalism, in the sense that we are incentivizing people to use all of their innovative and competitive kind of all of the characteristics that really have driven more value in most other industries. And in our case, they're simply driving us to over-treatment, over-diagnosis, overdoing, instead of having really capitalism in our tailwinds where we could be driving towards better health. And we have some really fantastic examples in the country of where we do have much better alignment in terms of our incentives and what we're trying to deliver. And my hope is that we can actually start to take some of those examples and spread them more widely across the country.
And we'll be talking about that. But I think the your just general point about headwinds, basically in the current system, we've cut all the feedback loops that normally encourage good performance, where people have skin in the game. You buy something. If you don't like it, you don't buy it again. You tell your friends. But you pay with your own money. The people who provide you that service have a profit motive and a will and an eagerness to avoid loss. And that's missing from the healthcare system for a variety of reasons for most patients. Not all, of course, but for most patients. For most patients, it's a third-party payment. So the customer for the hospital or the doctor's perspective is the insurance company or the government, rather than the person who's consuming the care. And the patient's kind of like an input. I start to think of it this way. It's sort of an input into the process. Necessary, of course, to run the tests. It's awkward to run the tests on if no one's in the CAT scan, but or in the ICU bed. But basically, it's the medical system reaching into my pocket as a taxpayer to do stuff on people who often sometimes don't need it, and sometimes it makes them worse. So that's the most cynical way I think you can put it.
Well, I think one realization that I really hope most people walk away from this book having is the fact that even though many of us don't go to see our physician all that often, and or if we do, maybe we pay $20 out of our pocket, we don't tend to think that we are paying for healthcare because it's covered by insurance or it's covered by the government. In fact, as you know, and as you're alluding to, we actually pay for it multiple times in multiple different ways. So we do pay for those co-pays. And actually, increasingly, our share of those co-payments has been sneaking upwards. So latest data show that we're actually paying about 30% of our healthcare payments, even when we are, quote, insured by our employer. And then, of course, we pay for it out of our taxes for Medicare, Medicaid, and other programs like that. And then finally, I think the most insidious factor, which has been hidden from us, is the fact that it's really coming out of our wages. That over the last 50 to 60 years, while the economy has grown, you know, our overall GDP has increased, the take home, what we're actually making as a country, has really not improved at all. And the delta, the difference between how the economy has really been taking off and what we're taking home as a population, that delta has really all gone to healthcare. And then most worrying to me was the statistic that I discovered that we're actually also losing in terms of our retirement monies. So increasingly, our employers are having to take out of our retirement money for the future and use that just simply to cover today's healthcare costs. So we are all paying for this. I mean, there's a example that I use. Len Saltz told me this story. He's a physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And he said, you know, Vivian, healthcare is like surf and turf. It's the surf and turf situation. I said, tell me what you mean by that. He said, well, you know, you go out to dinner with a whole group of people and you know you're going to split the bill at the end. So you're looking at the menu. I could get a hamburger. I could get a steak. We're splitting the bill. I'll get the steak. Then what happens? We all get the steak. That's the bill that we're paying it for in healthcare. It's the surf and turf problem.
I wrote a story about that. After I saw that example in your book, and a long time ago, I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal called "If You're Paying, I'll Have Sirloin," which is the same point. It was a statement about this idea that, well, it's true that, you know, that what you're doing with government money is wasteful, but I get my share too. As if that makes it okay. It doesn't. If you do it badly, if it's incentivized badly, everybody's going to be worse off because they're paying in total for something they don't value as much as it costs. I think you know, the point about healthcare's effect on wages, I think, is extremely important. We've talked a little bit about it on the program before. I think it would be okay if we were getting value for what we spent, if we were getting better health rather than just more health care. And I think that latter is the real problem. I want to talk about a personal example and get your reaction to it and make sure see if I have this right. My father passed away a couple of months ago, and the last 5 days, he was in the ICU, and we were with him most of the time. And I was struck by how heroic and really beautiful the healthcare he received was. And my joke was is that he got the same healthcare as the president of the United States would have gotten. In fact, I think he got better healthcare because I think some of the doctors probably wouldn't have been so excited about taking care of the current president. But put that to the side. He was 89. They spared no expense to try and get rid of the sepsis and the infections he had generally. He had a kidney issue. People say, what did he die of? He died of being 89. He had a lot of things wrong with him. And when we got into the ICU, they said, you know, we have to be honest with you. We don't think he's going to make it. And we said, well, let's, you know, give it a shot. And he rallied for a while. There was a chance they even got a little more optimistic. But, you know, tragically or sadly, he did not make it. But during those 5 days, it was extraordinary. And that was my thought at the time. You know, they did a chest ray every day, maybe more than once a day. They did tests every day. They had 5 tubes going into him with every drug possibly imaginable to try to reduce his infection chances and to improve his kidney function, et cetera, et cetera. And so at the time, I thought, this is really extraordinary. Later, I thought, I was aware of this because I'm an economist, but I was thinking, you know, we weren't making that decision. Who was making that decision? The answer, of course, is that Medicare was making that decision. You know, all of that expense was paid for by taxpayers. And there's something really extraordinarily beautiful about it, that even when you're 89, we don't want you to go. But it's unbelievably expensive, and no one in that setting had any incentive to take care of it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry for your loss, and I really appreciate you sharing that story with us. It's a very complicated question that you're raising. Maybe I'll just highlight a couple of reactions to hearing the story. I think, first of all, most physicians, when I was the dean of medical school, for example, I relived my experience again, you know, as a trainee. Most students and trainees are really taught to try to do everything we can to save lives.
Of course.
That's our primary goal. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book actually was because I realized that in the course of going through all of my training, it was so focused on diagnosing and then treating and hopefully healing people that I never was taught about how healthcare really works and how the system works and the business of healthcare, for example. And that's still true today. So from the perspective of those who were providing care for your father, I don't think that they were necessarily financially thinking about how their hospital might make more money because they ordered another x-ray. I think they were genuinely thinking, what can we do to save your father's life?
Sure.
I agree that they were not aware or probably not thinking about the costs, not constrained in any way by cost either, but I don't think that they were necessarily, I don't know, but I would assume, given my years in practice, I would assume that they were not personally incentivized by that at all. I do think that at the end of life, there are many decisions that individuals and families need to think about, if they can, to talk about just how much intervention they really want. We do know that many more people die in hospitals and intensive care units than would like to. Most people would prefer to die at home.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I've also seen so many people whose lives were saved in intensive care units, including today with COVID.
Yeah.
So these are very personal questions and very complicated questions. I do feel, though, outside of the context of, let's say, your father in the ICU, I think generally speaking, in our experience, in my experience at the University of Utah, for example, it is very helpful for physicians to understand what the costs are of the care that they're providing. Because in the absence of knowing about the cost, it's as if you invited somebody to come over and cater a dinner for you. and you sent them to the grocery store and there were no prices on anything.
Yeah, go for it.
Now, you could be pretty assured of a very nice meal, but probably the person could produce just as good of a meal at a lower cost if they were actually knew about the prices and what they were shopping for. So I feel the same way about healthcare. And we saw it when I was at the University of Utah, because we went through this period when all of a sudden we discovered, this was when I became the CEO, a couple of years after I was the CEO at the University of Utah Health, we discovered that we were going to be faced with a very different payment model for Medicaid for the state, where we would only get paid a fixed amount of money per patient per year. So the previous year, for example, we had a woman who had been in our emergency room for 52 times. Yeah. And in the previous year, because Medicaid was fee-for-service, every time she came in, we billed Medicaid and we got paid. Yeah. Now, we knew that probably wasn't the best
and said, way see you to soon. Care for her.
It wasn't the best way to care for her, but we also had a lot of other things we were working on.
Sure.
So she wasn't our top priority, probably. But as soon as we were told by Medicaid, hey, you know, next year, to care for that same woman, you're going to get paid this fixed amount of money. And if you end up spending more, that's going to be your loss. Well, now all of a sudden we started paying a lot more attention to what it was actually costing us to care for patients. And I had this really remarkable moment when I realized that we didn't actually know how much it cost us to run the business.
Yeah.
Not what we're charging, right? But just what does it cost us to run the business? Now, all hospitals, we know how much it costs to run the business as a whole. We know how much we spend on labor and on supplies and pharmacy. But for each individual patient to care for them, we had never worked that accounting out. And in fact, I discovered that almost no hospitals had actually worked that out. We were not the only ones. And so we really focused on doing that. And once we started doing that, we shared the cost information. Again, not what we were billing, but just how much did it cost for every catheter that we bought or hip prosthesis, or how much did it cost for every minute in the operating room or a minute in the emergency room. And as physicians, it was just completely eye-opening. Our orthopedic surgeons, I'll never forget when we discovered that the hip prosthesis that they were using to put in the artificial hips, there was a threefold difference in cost for those artificial hips. And of course, the patient outcomes, guess what? No significant difference.
Yeah.
So once we could start to see that, it's just like seeing the prices in the grocery store. All of a sudden say, well, you know what? I can get just as good of an outcome for this as that, or I can negotiate a better deal with that supplier. It really just changes the economics. So yeah. I think there are a lot of lessons learned. There are a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, I want to make clear that I think the, going back to my dad for a minute, the healthcare that most people in the United States receive is extraordinary. And I think that's often lost in our sadness and despair over the pricing and the tax bill and the future and all that. My dad was, as I said, was treated incredibly well with unbelievable. The technology in that room was just, it's mind blowing. The bed itself is a marvel. The drugs that were dripping into his veins are, you know, a triumph of science. The diagnostic devices, it's an amazing, amazing thing to be a patient in an American hospital, as long as they don't make a mistake, which you talk about in your book. Mistakes get made in every kind of hospital. But my point is that if you are covered, if you're an old person, or if you have a good corporate insurance, health insurance program, this is the gold standard. I think we often forget that. The problem is that, as I alluded to earlier, I don't think we get what we pay for, and we're buying the fanciest ingredients in that in that grocery aisle that don't impact necessarily outcomes. And coming back to this question of, I didn't mean to suggest that the head of the ICU is, we're going to run some more tests today, more money for us. But of course, the hospital often has an incentive to create programs and protocols and norms that do that. I mean, one example that drives me crazy is, the administration of say chemo, not in the ICU, but elsewhere. The doctor who administers that chemo is going to get more money than if they send the person out. And sometimes it's okay that it's in their office, but just the idea that that's all hidden from us and we don't see it. just the fact that we don't, as patients, ask about it. And even when we do ask, as you point out, and as we've talked about before, the hospital can't even tell us what the costs are, is a source of, I think, a lot of dysfunctions. I don't think it's something nefarious about it, but the current system is really not incentivized to be wise. It's incentivized to be active, which is really the point of the opening of your book. Let's turn to pricing generally. It's something that we talked a lot with Marty McCary about when we talked about his book, The Price We Pay. And it's, you know, as an economist, it's something on my mind. And we also talked about it with Keith Smith, who runs a surgical center in Oklahoma that posts its prices on the internet. There's no secrets. There's no surprise billing. There's no, quote, out of network. They only take cash. It's a phenomenal thing. Let's start. And I wanted to draw on your experience, not just what you have a fantastic chapter in the book about it, but also your experience as the CEO of Utah Health. Give readers, listeners, some idea of the charge master, which is a hilarious word. It should be called the retail price list, but charge master sounds like a Marvel Comics hero. Tell us about the charge master and the role it plays in hospital life.
The charge master is an area that I focus on in the book because I think that when we talk about price transparency, I'd love us to focus on the charge master. The charge master is a list of all services that are provided by a given hospital and the official full price, not the discounted, not negotiated anything, but just whatever is the official list price. It's like the list price of that service. It may include some supplies. It may include overall kind of a whole set of procedures, for example, that might roll up to a particular condition. It's basically this list. And in many states, in the effort to try to get more price transparency, they've been mandating that these charge masters be made public. So you can go onto the internet and you can look up all of the charge masters of the hospitals, for example, in California, if you're curious about that. And the law mandated that they actually become public, and states moved at varying paces to implement that. What it didn't require was that they be understandable or standardized. They had to be in machine-readable format. So they are PDFs, and most, for the most part, or spreadsheets. And what's remarkable about them is that they're completely inconsistent, and they're in lots of shorthand code that is really indecipherable to just about anybody. In fact, I couldn't understand most of the charge masters myself, and I've been in healthcare for more than two decades. I point out a few examples, some notable examples in my book, but you get the general idea. Now, some of these hospitals might list 2,000 or 3,000 items on their charge master. Some might list 8,000 or 10,000 on the charge master. So there's not even consistency in terms of, you know, you go in and you get an MRI. You think, okay, I'm getting an MRI of the brain. How hard can that be to compare one hospital's charge for an MRI of the brain with another hospital's charge with an MRI of the brain? But just the MRI of a brain, there might be 15 or 20 different flavors of it, you know, with or without contrast, with or without an angiogram, with or without. And most people really wouldn't understand those nuances at all. And so it makes the opportunity to compare or do anything in terms of price transparency, it just makes it really pretty meaningless. And that's the charge master. The charge master is also the starting point for negotiating prices. And that's another reason why I think it deserves a lot of focus and attention, because it's the full price, but no payer, or I would say very few insurers, would actually pay that price because they've negotiated it down. The only people who might possibly have to pay that full rate are those who can least afford it, the uninsured.
Right. But they don't pay it generally, and then they're going to get, sometimes they're sued, sometimes it's just written off as bad debt. You know,
That's right. Some hospitals, I mean, our hospital gave a fixed, pretty significant discount off of that price, but that practice varies considerably across the country. So yes. One effort, and there's been a lot in the news about price transparency and requiring hospitals to post their negotiated rates with insurers, for example, and make that public. And I'm not sure if that's actually going to go through or not. But one thing that really could make a huge difference, in my view, in terms of making the market function more like a market, is for hospitals to have to standardize their charge masters, just standard codes for every procedure and every supply that's used. It wouldn't be unusual in any other industry, but it would be very unusual in healthcare. And what that would enable is not necessarily consumers to be more effective. I mean, individuals to be more effective consumers, but the people who negotiate on their behalf could be employers, right, insurance companies, you know, business to business kind of work. And I think that's actually a huge opportunity in healthcare.
So let me ask a couple clarifying questions. Every health insurer has a different discount with even the same hospital, right? So if I'm a hospital, the price that Blue Shield gets is not the same price as Aetna, correct? Because that's been negotiated.
That would be correct.
Is it true across, is the discount, if I, let's talk within an insurer. If I'm Blue Shield, is the discount off the charge master the same for every item on the charge master, or is it individually negotiated?
That also varies.
Really? So that's really bizarre. So that those 10,000 prices, Blue Shield might say, we want a special deal on hip replacement of this kind, this flavor, this variation?
Typically, we wouldn't be negotiating each line. But there are areas where, for example, if you have the only neurosurgeon in town, who is the only person can remove brain tumors, it's pretty unlikely that that neurosurgeon is going to take any discounts or much of a significant discount.
Yeah. So that's one of the other challenges, of course, that certificate of need, which is a requirement in, I think, 36 states, that if you're opening a hospital, you have to get the permission of other hospitals in the area. Really lovely idea, horrible idea. And so there are a lot of areas that have limited competition. And so they are able to price accordingly, discount accordingly, et cetera.
Well, I'd say actually the position that I have about standardizing the charge master and standardizing services in the hospital also really applies across the industry. I think we need to standardize health insurance and the offerings within health plans, because I think it's very difficult for us as consumers. I don't know about you, but when it comes time around to figure out which plan that my employer is offering that I should choose, I'm actually as mystified as anybody is. I sit there and I try to read through the fine print. Again, I've been in this field for a long time. Yeah. It's very confusing.
Well,
I
only have a PhD in economics, so I can't understand it either. I'm serious. I'm just like you. I think something's deeply wrong when somewhat intelligent person with some education, which would be the two of us, have trouble figuring it out. And that includes, you know, how to register. I'm 65 and I did not register for Medicare. And I'm scared about it because I have a health savings account. Supposedly, if you have one, you don't have to register. But if you do have to register and you don't, you get in big trouble. It's remarkably difficult to figure out what you're supposed to do. And I don't know. It's a bad system. Let's go back to the charge master for a little bit more, though. I know this is not an easy question to answer, and I've asked it of some very smart people, and they can't answer it. But I'm going to give you a shot.
Oh, dear.
Brace yourself. It's
okay.
Okay, here we go. How does a hospital decide what to write down in the charge master next to procedure 473? Let's say, you know, it's the MRI.
How much to charge for it?
Yeah, in other words, the MRI with contrast, no angiogram. That's the line, whatever. And it's got this horrible three-digit code, or seven-digit, whatever it is, anagram, thing to describe it. Somebody has got to write down in the charge master what number that list price, that undiscounted retail price is. Who decides that, and how do they decide what number to put there? I have my own theory, but I want to hear yours.
Oh, yeah. My rather lighthearted answer to a very serious question, but my lighthearted answer is they write down whatever the number was last year.
Sure.
And they apply a small percentage increase to it.
Right. But in my experience, reading in your book, for example, and talking to other people, it tends to be about, quote, three times what Medicare reimburses people for. Is that generally true?
Actually, there was a paper that came out maybe in the last couple of years that looked at the overall rate that commercial insurers paid compared to Medicare for most services. And the average was around 2.5 to 3 times more. So what they actually paid, not the list price, but what they actually paid compared to Medicare was a multiplier. And it varied pretty considerably. There was really a pretty wide range. In some places they paid maybe close to what Medicare was paying, and in other places they paid a lot more.
But the Chargemaster is a lot higher than that, is what you're saying.
The Chargemaster can be higher.
So going back to that,
it varies quite a lot.
Going back to that, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin question. So besides the fact that you take what last year's was and you make it a little bit higher, is it just sort of custom of what that original starting number is? Because it's kind of irrelevant, except that for the people who, as we talked about, who can't pay, then they could be on the hook for it. People who don't have insurance could be on the hook for it. It does make – it allows, as some have suggested on the program, it allows – the insurer to brag about, oh, we did really well for your employees. We got a big discount for you. Is there anything more to it than that?
I think it's a pretty common business practice, right? You mark it up to mark it down. And as you say, they can brag that they've done something great for their customers. Same thing is true for list prices for pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
The PBMs can offer a huge discount against the list price.
That's the pharmaceutical benefit managers.
Pharmaceutical benefit managers.
Sorry.
And a couple of points that are maybe relevant to make about that are that, at least when I was at the University of Utah, we had to provide an enormous amount of charity care and uncompensated care. One of the consequences of having a population that's not insured is that you have a lot of patients who show up in your emergency room who just frankly don't have insurance, and we have to provide care for them. We want to provide care for them, but that care is costly. We as physicians mostly do not know a person's insurance in the hospital when we're caring for them. That's sort of a very closely held principle. All swear to the Hippocratic Oath. You know, we care for people regardless of their insurance status within the hospital. We try to provide very good care. And so as a result, every year there was a pretty significant amount of free and charity care that we had to cover. So there is a fair amount of cost shifting in healthcare where the commercial insurers or those who pay a little bit more for services, those dollars are used to subsidize the underpayment on the other side. It's really not an ideal system in any way, shape, or form. And there are, as I said, definitely ways that we could be doing it better. We're seeing, for example, these better systems much more resilient in the face of COVID-19. Our VA system that pays for VA hospitals, our Department of Defense that pays for the military health system, all of the military hospitals, some of our Medicare Advantage programs that are funding new kinds of clinics in the private sector, they're all demonstrating a significantly more resilient response to COVID than our fee-for-service practices we've been talking about so far. So I hope that we'll be able to, in the face of this crisis, really accelerate some of the movement to more robust and more sensible, frankly, business practices for healthcare.
I'm glad you brought up uncompensated care, because that was my next question. Keith Smith, the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, suggested that there was at least a time in health policy where the amount, hospitals were compensated by federal government for uncompensated care, and that the calculation of that amount that they were due was related to the discount off that list price. Do you think that's true?
There are some programs.
Because that's a really bad incentive.
there are some programs that try to support hospitals that provide a disproportionate amount of care to the uninsured.
Yeah.
And they're designed in different ways. One of them is to provide discounted pharmaceuticals to those hospitals. I think, a more direct form of support. For example, having more people, frankly, have health insurance to begin with would probably be a much more sensible way of managing.
But I mentioned that because, you know, that's such a perverse incentive, if true, that you would be incentivized to post a high list price to make it look like you were losing more money than you otherwise would on paying patients. It seems like a really weird thing. And it's another area where I've tried to find out if that's true, and it's almost impossible to discover.
Whether the people are intentionally posting higher list prices,
not literally,
to claim that?
Or? No, whether they have an incentive to, even if they don't literally calculate that number. The program you're talking about of compensated for people without insurance, I think it's called DISH, DSH, right? And
yes,
the administration of that, how that actually works, is so opaque. I cannot get anyone yet to explain it to me. I'm not suggesting you should do that now, if you do understand it. But my point is that it would be an unfortunate thing if it turned out that the larger your list price, the easier it was to collect money from the federal government for care that you provided with no compensation. So, you know, a homeless person walks in, needs emergency surgery, gets it. If the amount that you would get back from the federal government, because you lived in a neighborhood, as you say, that had a disproportionate, because your hospital was in a neighborhood with a disproportionate share of uninsured people, that the amount you would get back from that program would be related to how much you pretended to charge, which was the claim, would be very disturbing. I don't know if that's true. That's what I'm trying to find out. Any thoughts on that?
I don't really have any thoughts on that. I know that we provided over $100 million of charity and uncompensated care when I was at the University of Utah. I can't address what you just asked.
But when you use that phrase, go ahead, sorry.
Well, the other comment that I was going to make is that many of the systems who provide a disproportionate amount of care to the uninsured are academic medical systems. Mm-hmm. And many of these academic systems also are very closely affiliated with county hospitals, city hospitals, for example, where, again, a disproportionate number of people who are uninsured get their care. And as an academic medical system, in addition to providing care to anybody who arrives as a public academic system, we also bore the responsibility of training and conducting research.
Sure.
And so much of our we actually had to rely on clinical funds to also support training, because training is really underfunded as well. So there are many, the cost shifting within healthcare is very complicated and is underwriting so much of our future in terms of both research and education. And I think that untangling the spaghetti would be really a hugely important first step in getting to a more rational healthcare system.
Agreed. But, you know, you mentioned without it, the words rolled off your tongue effortlessly. You said, we provided, I think you said, hundreds of millions of dollars of uncompensated care. That calculation has to be made to get the compensation from the government in this program. How do you
We weren't compensated for
you were not
from the government. No.
No, but some systems are. And I think the challenge is the phrase, we spent all this money, you have to know your costs for that. I don't know how that's the Byzantine part of this, is that number is not easily calculated, because as you say, you often the hospital can't tell you the price. I'm not sure they can tell you the costs. We can leave it alone, but I think that calculation is what is partly what's at stake here in this issue of incentives.
Well, it is complicated. I think the longer view is, how can we get to a point where healthcare is affordable for everybody?
Yeah, and I would emphasize
that at the end of the day is really what we're trying to achieve.
And I would emphasize healthcare, not healthcare insurance, which often are treated as if they're the same thing. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the things you highlight in the book, there are many that are, I would call, sources of optimism, things that you see happening that are getting us to both better outcomes and more wiser outcomes in terms of how money is spent. You talk about telemedicine, you talk about the VA, as you mentioned. And I think the other impetus is things like looking at quality of life years and quality of care rather than fee for service. Talk about where we're moving, how we're moving in those directions. Medicare Advantage would be another example. Talk about some of those changes that are happening now as people are trying to get to a better system.
Sure. Medicare Advantage is a great story that I think is gaining momentum and is really demonstrating some real advantages during this COVID crisis. So with Medicare, government-run program, largest single payer in this country, has really traditionally been fee-for-service. So if you're a senior who comes into our clinic, we bill Medicare for every procedure that we do and every study that we do, for example, until this new Medicare Advantage model came about. So in Medicare Advantage, it's now about a third of all Medicare patients. Wow. In a subset of those. So it's not in all Medicare Advantage, but in a subset of Medicare Advantage, there are special contracts that have been designed between medical groups of doctors, and Medicare. And the arrangement is such that Medicare pays that group of physicians to care for their patients with a fixed amount of money per year. And they define that amount of money based on how sick or healthy the patient is. If they're more complicated, they pay more. Now, over the course of the year, the medical group is responsible for keeping that individual healthy and satisfied. Actually, patient satisfaction scores are very important in their evaluation. And at the end of the year, if the patient has stayed healthy, meaning and out of the hospital, which is probably the best measure of that, then the medical group actually can save money. And if the patient has had to go into the emergency room and hospital multiple times, the medical group has to pay those bills. So it's a model where the physicians are actually directly incentivized to keep patients healthy and not necessarily over-treat or over-diagnose, but to do the right amount of treatment. And what's happened as a result of that has been really fascinating is the groups that have taken this on over the last 5 to 10 years have completely reinvented primary care. They've really focused on what seniors need to stay healthy. They know that they need to be seen and they need a reasonable amount of time in the clinic and their appointments. So instead of rushing through 8 to 10 minute visits, they get 30 minutes, even an hour as a new patient. They need to be seen. So if they have transportation problems, they offer shuttle or car service, transportation services, for example, to get to and from clinic. They have on-site pharmacies. Falls prevention is a huge topic for seniors, so yeah. They offer yoga and tai chi, and they even have social nights and events just to combat loneliness and social isolation that affects so many seniors, so many people, really. Yeah. And so as a result, the data are really impressive. They are able to, even though they spend more money on primary care, they really do reduce the hospitalizations considerably, and no senior goes into a hospital coming out, or very few come out that much better. So reducing hospitalizations is really a huge factor in terms of improving independence. And overall, when you take it all together, they save money. So these programs, these clinics like ChenMed and Iora Health and Leon Med and CareMore, they're really starting to proliferate across the country. And I really hope that seniors will... that they will act in their best interest and try to identify these clinics because they're a much more promising model for the future for primary care.
And they're essentially in competition with each other to attract those Medicare Advantage patients. Is that right?
Sure. They're in competition to keep those Medicare patients on their rolls year after year. Medicare patients can change their mind and they can move their business, bring their care elsewhere. And so they are in competition, yes.
Is this much different than an HMO? Isn't this sound like an HMO, a health maintenance organization, but it's funded by government rather than by, say, an employer or individuals?
It's pretty similar. I think that what we're seeing in terms of the way in which these are rolling out, there's been, I think, more latitude, more innovation in the way in which these medical groups are actually rolling out these models. And there are efforts, for example, in Iora Health to extend these to groups of employers, for example, and their employees.
Yeah. Yeah.
So kind of extending the model. So I think there's the opportunity for a wider spread adoption of these kinds of changes.
So I mentioned the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, which posts prices on the internet, cash only, no insurance. It's also an enormous, I hope, growing thing called direct primary care, which is just you go in and you pay cash. And it's cheap, but and they don't do everything for you. But they can do a lot of things. These the doctors who run these programs, are these programs a way to to introduce a little bit of sanity into how we, you know, as that gap grows of wastefulness in administrative care, it opens the door for other models to get in.
I think we are starting to see enough potentially disruptive forces in primary care. Between the Oklahoma surgery model, between some of these Medicare Advantage models and direct. What's going to be really interesting in the next few years is the degree to which this kind of mindset can extend to secondary tertiary care, to hospitalizations,
yeah.
and to rehabilitation. That's really where more of the dollars are spent right now. The opportunities in primary care are really around prevention.
Yeah.
So prevention is by far the most cost-effective investment, of course, and so I'm very optimistic about those extending and spreading. And what's going to be really interesting is whether we can enable the same kind of changes to start to happen in our hospital systems, which are going to be much more difficult. It's a much more complicated environment. Hospitals are also, they have larger fixed costs. They have thin margins.
Yeah.
You know, the average margin for a hospital is 2%. Last year, so much more risk averse in terms of thinking about trying new payment models. But if I think Churchill said, never waste a good crisis. So there is a moment now that we're facing with the COVID crisis where we may be able to see some innovation, some willingness between payers and provider systems to partner more effectively to try out some new models.
So it strikes me, you mentioned hospitals. It seems to me, I'm an advocate for a much more free market system, an idea that whose time will probably never come, but I like thinking about it anyway. It seems to be one of the challenges to my view and to your hopefulness about other ways to get there from here of avoiding the fee-for-service is that there's a big difference between going into the doctor for a blood test, your primary care physician, say, or going into your primary care physician for a sprained ankle or broken finger versus going into a surgery center for a hip replacement. Those are all kind of similar because you kind of know the hernia, the appendicitis. There are surprises, but the standard of care is pretty straightforward. Once you get into the ICU and you get into complications and post-surgery stuff, the menu of stuff you can do or try, I mean, it's again, a glorious testament to human creativity and innovation, but you know, you can have whatever you want. You can do you can do so many diagnostic tests, and it's not always clear what the right. It's not like replacing the hip. There's so much variation. It seems to me that's going to be a big challenge in any of these ways to make things better.
I think it's a challenge. It's also an opportunity. One of the lessons that I try to talk about in this book, The Long Fix, is the opportunity to create what we call the learning health system. We are beginning to see the rewards of investing in digitizing all of our health data in hospitals through these electronic medical records. In the beginning, I believe that they've been primarily used as very expensive billing and coding machines.
Yeah.
But over time, I think we are starting to see that there's a lot that can be learned from experiences with very complicated patients with very complicated conditions. One area, for example, that I have thought about a lot is my own. I'm an MRI radiologist, and reading MRI studies from patients who have a whole wide range of diagnoses and conditions, get very little feedback over the years in terms of just what actually happened with that patient. Was that diagnosis that I made correct or not? Or if the diagnosis was correct, which hopefully it was, what happened to that patient with the different therapies that were tried? That information is actually all in those electronic medical records. Right. And the question is, how can we extract useful insights from it? That would be the case, I think, in the intensive care unit more than any place. We have pretty good understanding, as you said, of how to care for a patient who might need an artificial hip or caring for a patient with appendicitis. But patients with sepsis, very complicated. Right. All different kinds of sepsis. Sepsis really isn't one diagnosis. So how can we learn more about that? And there's been some really interesting research that's shown with artificial intelligence that we can actually start to detect sepsis much earlier with these automated algorithms. They can use AI to identify earlier than we would ordinarily be able to detect as clinicians. Those kinds of capabilities, I think, are just in their infancy. So I hope that our investment in digitizing our healthcare system is going to finally pay off there.
What's your feeling about top-down mandates to spread that information or standardize it? We talked a little bit about price transparency. There's an executive order. I think it goes into effect December 31st of this year in theory. I heard you say, well, maybe not, but that would require more transparency from the federal government imposed on the system. Obviously, we can impose the sharing of information like you're talking about. And it's true that the digital world gives us a chance to do that. Do you think it should be mandated? Do you think that's a good idea?
I think if you want the healthcare system to operate with free market advantages, then you need to enable that market to be a free market. So I think it is really important to have transparency and standardization go hand in hand. As we talked about with the charge master, you can have as much transparency of a charge master as you want. It doesn't do anyone any good when it's not standard.
If you can't understand it.
It doesn't mean anything to anybody. So I think that not everything can be standardized, as you pointed out, but many things can. And where they can be standardized, I think standardization is going to be very helpful. It's helpful for business-to-business interactions in healthcare, hospitals or health plans that need to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies or pharmaceutical benefit managers on prices that they're willing to pay for medication. You need transparency about the effectiveness of those medications in order to be an effective negotiator of that. And when it comes to negotiating between hospitals and insurance plans about services, you need some standardization of what services you're negotiating over.
Sure.
I think those are actually going to be important. Whether they should be top down or include the voices of those who are on the front lines actually providing care, or even better, including some patient voices into how we should be thinking about some of the standards, I think those are all up for discussion.
So one of the positive results of the pandemic for me as someone who cares about more competition is that at least some states, maybe all states, have relaxed some of their occupational licensing restrictions to allow nurses, say, from outside New York, because New York was hit so hard. I'd love to see those kind of restrictions permanently lifted. The use of telemedicine, which you talk about in the book, obviously the opportunity to be able to do telemedicine, either as a Medicare patient or as a health insurance patient across state lines, it's a huge game changer. Obviously, that market's very embryonic. It hasn't really evolved, but it would evolve, I think, very quickly if it was allowed legally to be used that way. Do you think that's important? Do you think there's some important stuff there to that could happen?
Absolutely. I think that's really been a silver lining to this COVID crisis, is the ability to really tear down many of these barriers. Telehealth has actually been around for a long time. More than 20 years ago, radiology was doing telehealth with teleradiology. Sure. We could transmit the digital images, and I could read MRIs from Michigan or California or Wisconsin, even though I was sitting in New York. Now, in order to do so, I had to be licensed in each of those states. Right. So I remember filling out stacks of paperwork, and literally it was stacks of real paper that then had to be scanned and transmitted. And it was, you know, every document about my training ever accumulated, incredibly inefficient, incredibly costly, and kind of wasteful, really. So as you
think that was the idea
with telehealth, the new regulations around COVID, now that barrier has been lifted completely. And we're really seeing not only has COVID reduced the administrative burdens, but it's also done a couple of other very important things. One, it has agreed to reimburse for telehealth.
Right.
And two, it's really encouraged culture change. So many physicians and patients, I think, would have been doubtful about the use of tele everything until now. It's really changed our whole society. And we're seeing, for example, one of the products that we have in our company is a product that is a virtual diabetes clinic that we had, of course, before COVID. It's for patients who have type 2 diabetes. And of course, patients with type 2 diabetes are at increased risk of COVID, as you know, along with people who have other chronic diseases. This technology includes not only the ability to do telecommunications, to do video conferencing with a physician and chatting with a coach, but it actually also has a sensor, a device that's about the size of a key fob, that's a continuous glucose monitor that you can put on your arm and or on your abdomen. And now, instead of having to prick your finger to check your blood or to go into the doctor to have a blood test, you can actually monitor your blood sugar 24/7 and have your blood sugar transmit to the app on your phone. You can see how your sugars are changing 24/7 with respect to the meals that you're eating and how you're exercising. And instead of keeping a food log, which is really tedious and almost nobody does that who's a diabetic, you actually can take pictures of your meals and snacks.
Yes.
And the artificial intelligence actually even recognizes the meals, which is pretty remarkable. So now, instead of being lectured, you know, Vivian, you really shouldn't eat that second slice of pecan pie, it actually shows you, well, you know, if you want to do it, this is the last three times you did that. Here's what it did to your blood sugar. And by the way, when you exercised, here's some good things that happened. Or next time you eat that big hamburger, take the top bun off. Let's just try that. You know, it makes recommendations. It's actually really engaging. So I think the ability to provide care virtually, we're learning you don't have to be in the four walls of the clinics or the four walls of the hospital to get that care. And in making that transition and in providing insurance coverage now, which really wasn't possible, Medicare didn't cover the continuous glucose monitors until very recently, I think we're going to start to see some of that digital health, digital technology liberated. Which has a lot of potentially really good implications downstream for people.
So that's extraordinary. And we've had Eric Topol on the program a number of times talking about some of the revolution that's going on there in that world. Of course, some of it is slowed by regulation. Some of it's an end around trying to avoid, you know, any issues related to regulation. But the current system is very sclerotic. It's kind of designed to move very, very slowly. So let's close talking about maybe your optimism, and you seem to have some. You know, it's called the long fix, but I think you imply somewhere in the book it's only 10 years. That would be amazing. If it's only 10 years, I'd be so excited. We have a better healthcare system in 10 years. But talk about you and your journey. You've had an extraordinary career. You've been a practicing radiologist. You've run a healthcare system. And now you're doing this very different thing, which I'm sure some people thought you were crazy. Maybe family members, maybe friends. You've leapt into this very different world. Talk about that experience for you and where you see Verily, which is the company you're with now, which is very different than being a healthcare administrator, I think, but correct me if I'm wrong, where you see that taking the healthcare system, what role it could play in the future.
I did have a fair number of mixed opinions about the decision to leave healthcare and academic medicine, actually, and to move into digital technology.
Traitor.
Mostly actually encouraging. No, actually really encouraging. Because the thought was, here was the advice that was given to me. If you go and become a CEO of another healthcare system, which is where I was headed, if you're lucky, will have a good experience there, and you'll be able to influence that community for the good. along with thousands of other people, of course, in that healthcare system. The opportunity in a digital technology company like Verily is to really have that impact at scale. And the virtual diabetes clinic is an example of that, because what you're talking about there is a technology that anybody who has a smartphone or access to the internet can use. It addresses the issue of the lack of availability of healthcare in rural and underserved areas. When I was in Utah, we covered vast amounts of America in Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, with very few physicians or nurses. And so this kind of technology supports care there. And it's also, what's remarkable about it is that it is really personalized in a way that healthcare isn't. We still mostly do a one-size-fits-all when we practice medicine. I mean, we talk a lot about gender, just simply, do our research studies have women versus men?
Yeah.
Well, that is one difference between people, but actually I would say that we are all very individual in our biology and our sociology and in our psychology. And technologies like this really understand that in ways that just leapfrog anything that we're doing in healthcare. So if I have type 2 diabetes, I'm actually looking at my own physiology. We're actually seeing, for example, that if you and I both had a banana, how it would affect our blood sugar actually would be very different.
Yeah.
And so the data that are being provided to people to care for their own health is personalized, really, really personalized. And the ways in which we can incentivize or motivate people or engage them in caring about their health and in doing better for themselves is, I think, much more powerful at a personal level, especially when it's on their time and at their convenience. So I'm very optimistic about the role of technology in helping us move forward. Of course, like all things, it can be used for good, it can be used for bad. But this is a time where I think if we have enough people who do come from the healthcare side who really understand the good that we are trying to achieve, that this can be a force multiplier, that we can really start to leapfrog and maybe accelerate that long fix and make it just a little bit less long, a little bit faster.
Let's close with one thing you would do if you could to make innovation easier, to make a transformation to a better healthcare system easier. You have a lot of recommendations in the book. At the end of each chapter, you have really interesting ideas about how to make things better on the part of patients, physicians, policymakers. But of course, some of those are just ideals, like people should care more about X. Those are hard to implement. They're not really implementable. Can you pick a thing or two that you would do that you think would make a transition to make that long fix a little shorter to get to?
I think the most important thing that has to be done is we have to articulate it as a nation that we are going to prioritize health and move our payment model forward towards value-based payment in an accelerated fashion, to really put a stake in the ground and set some deadlines and say, as of this date, 2022, we're going to achieve this, and by 2024, we're going to achieve that. The whole system will respond. It already has been moving. It's been moving under each administration. As you know, Obamacare was Romney Care, and now actually Secretary Azar and Seema Verma are actually continuing to move forward that value agenda. It has been bipartisan, actually. And we just need to accelerate that change and put a stake in the ground and declare we are going to pay for better health. We're not going to be fee-for-service anymore. The days of fee-for-service are numbered. Let the tailwinds of capitalism push us forward.
My guest today has been Vivian Lee. Her book is The Long Fix. Vivian, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.